Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a couple of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and talk about the Russian President Vladimir Putin's trip to Washington and his visit at the White House and then also at Camp David. And we'll try and get a sense of what has been on the agenda vis-a-vis Iraq. And we'll be speaking in a moment with Susan Eisenhower, who's the president of the Eisenhower Institute. We'll also speak with Nina Khrushcheva, who is a professor of international affairs at the New School in New York, where a week ago Paul Wolfowitz visited and gave a speech which was roundly heckled. So we're getting also talk to Nina about both what happened at the New School and the visit to Columbia University by President Putin. We'll also talk with Rahul Mahajan, who is the author of Full Spectrum Dominance, U.S. Power in Iraq and Beyond. He's also the author of a recent article, Gunpoint Democracy in Iraq. We'll be talking to him about the privatization of U.S. foreign policy and defense policy in terms of the contracts that are being let in Iraq. And we'll also follow that up with a conversation with Phil Coyle, who is a former Assistant Secretary of Defense and head of test evaluation at the Pentagon, and talk to him about the new examples of a revolving door, which is a long-standing problem in Washington. But however, the door is revolving at an accelerated pace under the new Bush administration, an example of which is that Governor Bush's former chief of staff from Texas, who then went on to head FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, which he just left 3 months ago, is now the head of New Bridges Strategy. And just on the basis of what he's offering up here, briefly, I can read the opening paragraph. New Bridges Strategy, LLC, is a unique company that was created specifically with the aim of assisting clients to evaluate and take advantage of business opportunities in the Middle East following the conclusion of the U.S.-led war in Iraq. Its activities will seek to expedite the creation of free and fair markets and new economic growth in Iraq, consistent with the policies of the Bush administration. The opportunities evolving in Iraq today are of such an unprecedented nature and scope that no other existing firm has the necessary skills and experience to be effective both in Washington, D.C. and on the ground in Iraq. So we're talking about, the privatization of foreign policy and defense policy. I'm speaking with Susan Eisenhower, who's the president of the Eisenhower Institute. And clearly, President Bush is fading his friend Vladimir Putin. And it was some time back where he looked into his eyes and saw his soul. So how is this love match going?
Well, I would say that it's going relatively well, I think, on a personal basis. I think Bush reiterated how much he enjoyed spending a quote-unquote quality time with the Russian president. I thought that was rather interesting. But
yeah, what does it say for all the other people he's met with?
Well, I know. I think the interesting thing is here, though, whatever kind of relationship they have, and it certainly appears to be good, especially if you hear them both talk about it. But the real question is, does this get translated down to the lower ranks of those who are engaged in trying to put flesh on the bones of this relationship? And I think that's a greater question. They clearly, they have a personal appreciation for one another, but where it gets down to some of the, you know, major cooperative ventures that are underway, you know, there's still plenty of obstacles in U.S.-Russian relations.
So, in other words, comparing that to the Clinton administration, where the vice president had a close personal relationship with Chernomyrdin, there was a kind of continual contact there. Is there any such link, or is it this is just the relationship ebbs and flows with the various photo opportunities when the leaders meet?
Well, I think you're right. I think this tends to be a little bit more of a driven by photo opportunity. During the Clinton administration, there was something called the Gore-Chernomyrdin process, which was a kind of overarching framework for vetting the progress of certain cooperative efforts. And I think that was a very useful tool because it met regularly and there were assignments between meetings and, you know, there was some kind of mechanism for advancing things. Now, they have set up a couple of working groups on missile defense and other things, but the problem with these working groups is that they are not part of a structure, an ongoing structure at the kind of Gore Chernomyrdin level. And because, you know, this relationship is not a well-established one, it's only a little more than 10 years old, the relationship, I believe, is suffering from not having the kind of ongoing high-level leadership that we had in the previous administration.
But Susan Eisenhower, you could argue that during the Yeltsin years, things were a little iffy and they were going through a much more of a kleptocratic kind of transfer or transition, I should say. And now under Putin, things seem to be settling down a bit. The economic growth of Russia, would the U.S. would wish to be in, have those kind of numbers. It seems that things are sort of settling down a little bit.
I think there's no question that things are settling down as Russia moves towards Duma elections in December and then on to Putin's re-election. There's no question, based on what the scenario looks like today versus during the Yeltsin period, that enormous improvements have been made. But you could also argue that U.S.-Russian cooperation has never been more important. I think we saw during the summit failure to get any kind of substantive agreement over the post-war Iraq situation, ongoing difficulties and differences over nuclear power cooperation with Iran. You still have, the at least lip service paid to missile defense cooperation, but I think there's a long haul on that one. We don't hear about it too much, but there are a number of very important difficulties that the International Space Station is facing with respect to U.S.-Russian cooperation that has been up till now really very successful. But there are just a number of areas, and then not to mention the fact that here we are, more than a decade later, and Jackson-Vanik and other trade restrictions stand in the way of Russia really feeling like it's moving into the international arena in a meaningful way. So I would dare say that if they decided to reestablish a high-level commission like this, they'd have plenty to do to keep themselves busy.
And I imagine, Susan Eisenhower, that Iraq was very much on the table, and of course the Soviet Union and Russia inherited the Iraq as a major debtor, they're the first in line to be repaid, and of course the French as well, and the oil's not coming out. So, but I think at a deeper level, isn't there something going on here between the U.S. And Russia trying to come to terms with a joint strategy on the global war on terror? And to that extent, it seems that Putin wants a free hand in Chechnya. He brought along Ahmed Kadyrov, who's an extremely unsavory character, and I don't see how he could have been that inept in terms of his PR to have done that. But so is that the subtext here? We'll help you on the war on terror, but you've got to give us a free pass in vis-a-vis human rights in Chechnya.
Well, I think the situation in Chechnya is extremely complicated. I think it is. It's well known that Al Qaeda took advantage of the situation after, really the collapse of the Chechen environment after the first war. I think there's no question that there is help in that conflict from these outside forces. Just as they are turning up in Iraq. But having said that, of course, the situation is considerably more complicated, as you point out, because the Chechens are part of the Russian Federation, and certainly the conflict has had overtones, of a war of liberation, you could say. But nevertheless, Russia has suffered from some rather stunning cases of catastrophic. Well, catastrophic is too strong a word, but certainly very dramatic and tragic cases of terrorism. One only need remember that situation in the theater in Moscow. I guess it was almost a year ago, which I think was one of the most, truly a terrifying situation. You remember where the...
they pumped the gas in and...
The gas situation, yes, but being held hostage by a group of terrorists with bombs strapped around their waist must have been perfectly... A living nightmare for those innocent people who've been in the theater.
But isn't that what the Russians are saying to us? We have our 9/11 problem just as you do?
Well, you see, yes. I mean, and so what this really requires from the administration is an extremely sophisticated policy, because on the one hand, there are human rights abuses, and the Chechens do have legitimate grievances. On the other hand, there is an element of terrorism, so this is very difficult. I think the United States gets into an increasingly difficult situation when it talks about human rights and other issues, though, until we ourselves sort out, you know, some of the ongoing, unresolved questions at Guantanamo and other places ourselves. So, you know, finding exactly the right tone on how to approach this is extremely important, because we vitally need Russia's cooperation, intelligence cooperation in Afghanistan. Clearly, the international community and its relationship to the Iraq situation has to be sorted out. We've got some very big items on this agenda. And, of course, the big challenge for any administration is always to figure out how to prioritize and to decide what are the most important things that have to be advanced. You're not going to be able to win every fight with everybody at all times. So this, you know, has to require some kind of sophisticated policy.
And is it? I understand from the back in the Yeltsin days, Yeltsin, in fact, a couple of times mentioned that he, to some extent, blamed the previous policies of the U.S. In Afghanistan for creating this monster. In other words, we stimulated Islamic militancy to fight communism, and now we're reaping the whirlwind. And you have lots of contacts with senior Russians. Is there a sort of residual bitterness there? It's pretty clear from the record that every terrorist that struck the United States prior to 9/11 and since, almost every one of them goes back to the alumni from
that group.
From that Mujahideen group that the U.S. and trained CIA with Saudi cut out in the ISI of Pakistan.
Well, I think U.S. involvement in the way it was conducted comes under the heading of it seemed like a good idea at the time. The problem is here, of course, if any Russians are advancing that argument, is that there would not have been the necessity for a band of freedom fighters to fight this conflict if the Russians hadn't been in there in the first place. So I think there's ample amount of blame to be spread around with respect to how Afghanistan found itself in this very troubling position. This, however, does not excuse anyone for sitting on the sidelines or, by the way, diverting attention away from the enormous task of rebuilding Afghanistan. And I, while it's very clear that we're going to have this huge undertaking in Iraq, I get very concerned when I see Afghanistan drop off the front page of the paper, because this country has to be a model in some way for whether or not it's come out better at the other end, having been subject to a U.S. intervention. Furthermore, being bordering Pakistan brings with it all kinds of special challenges, and we need to be very alert to what is still required of us there. We really don't have many troops in Afghanistan.
But haven't we, to some extent, given the Russians a free pass there because of their relationship with the Northern Alliance, who we essentially depended upon to win the war, and they've subsequently been rewarded with a certain amount of autonomy, at least in terms of the defense minister?
Well, I don't think that you could say a free pass. NATO, of course, has troops there.
Right.
And that's unprecedented, actually, that NATO would be in Afghanistan, when you think of what kind of sensitivities that might have on other, you know, any other historical circumstances.
Well, they're certainly not in Iraq, are they?
Well, no, they're not. But there's still time, I guess. I don't know. In any case, you know, I would say, generally speaking, there are some very, very big issues before us, not the least of which, by the way, are issues of a positive nature. There's no question that a lot of talk since September 11th has revolved around a major objective of the United States to become as independent as possible from our dependence on oil coming from countries in the world that pose a strategic challenge to the United States. And certainly a lot of effort is being put into thinking through the U.S.-Russian energy environment, because Russia can, in some ways, begin to help bridge that gap. In fact, during this trip, Putin went to the opening of Lukoil gas station. Lukoil bought Getty, and there was a lot of talk about this potential cooperation over time. But of course, that is very complicated with other things like pipelines and infrastructure and getting the oil to the market and other considerations. So there is a positive agenda still in place.
Well, of course, if things go sour in the Middle East, and there's always a potential for that, I think, for example, if the Israelis were to either neutralize or arrest or expel Arafat, the whole Arab world may erupt, and then you would have a repeat of the oil embargo of the 1970s. I don't think the Saudi royal family would have much choice but to turn off the spigot, and stepping up to the plate would be the Russians, right?
Well, certainly they would love to step up to the plate and do everything they could. It's good for their business, and they understand that it fits, the requirements here in this country. The problem is that you just don't turn on resources overnight. And there are, of course, there really is an infrastructure question in Russia. This is a country whose oil industry, became old and out of date. And so there is going to have to be, substantial investment in some of these oil fields. But I still think it's a positive thing. We're talking about actually deepening our cooperation to address a bigger issue. And so it's nice that there is an area where Russia can possibly make a substantial difference to the United States. I'd go back to the space station. We are completely dependent on the Russians right now for any transportation back and forth to the space station. And there's no question that after the Columbia tragedy, NASA and the U.S. government looked around and said, well, what is the value of this partnership? And for no additional money, the Russians stepped forward and offered their capability. So I think these are all very positive things. And while we've got some big agenda items related to Iran and trying to mobilize, Russia on some of these other questions, I think actually the trend looks like a positive one.
Well, just in closing, Susan Eisenhower, somewhat off the subject, but your grandfather, of course, became a president, and he was essentially working for a Democratic administration, and now people are using echoes of your grandfather's presidency to apply to the entry of General Clark into the race. Do you have any any sense that there's any historical connections there?
Well, I think General Clark ought to be liberated from the memory of Dwight Eisenhower, the extent that obviously they're both military men and they both sought the presidency. But I think that's really where the parallel ends. And the reason I say that is that we live in a very, very different world. And, it's pretty hard to be compared to somebody who commanded forces for, one of the most devastating wars, in the history of the world. And I think that General Clark has got lots to say to everybody on a range of subjects, not only related to our national security, but our domestic developments. And it may not be to Clark's advantage to, have that overplayed, besides the fact that, there are quite some years between these two candidacies. I think Clark is a patriotic American, just as Eisenhower was, and he thinks he has something he can bring to the table here. And that's maybe where the parallel ought to end.
I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles.
It was a real pleasure, Ian.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. So just speaking then with Susan Eisenhower, who's the president of the Eisenhower Institute. I'm now speaking with Nina Kusheva, who's a professor of international affairs at the New School in New York. And Nina, did you run into Putin at Columbia University?
Hi, Ian. Hi. Actually, I didn't. We were sitting in the audience and he was on stage, so
I
did not shake his hand.
You didn't get any what they call FaceTime?
No, we didn't get any FaceTime. Almost nobody, probably nobody did except President Bollinger, president of Columbia University.
So you didn't get to look into his eyes and see his soul?
I did. I actually did look in his gray, steely eyes, and I had never seen so little soul in anybody.
So you saw a secret policeman?
I just think that Putin could show his soul, and I'm sure he has one, but only if he decides he wants to, because I think he's really a very well-trained Secret Service agent or intelligence agent, and he really doesn't do those things unless he has a reason to do them.
And what is this dichotomy between this man who was hanging out with Paul McCartney and saying how the Beatles changed his life, and this man who closes down the press and has all of his KGB cronies in key positions throughout his administration? So where do you put him between the Beatles and the KGB?
Man, I think that's what's kind of interesting, and I sort of listen on a little bit on Susan Eisenhower's bit, and she said it's a different time, and that's what I would sort of reiterate. It is a different time. It's the same man. It's the man who absolutely embraces modern issues, open issues, cultural issues, especially in terms of art, culture, movies, entertainment, all sorts of things. On one hand, and on the other hand, it is a man that came out of the Soviet system and still believes in great Russia, and the way to make Russia great is to make sure it's orderly and obedient, and that's what he feels is necessary for the Russian people. And also with this closing of the media, I mean, if you talk to Putin, if you listen to Putin, he would explain it to you in the most brilliant way, that it's really, we didn't close anything, it's just we're really trying to privatize certain organizations to make sure that private organizations, and in particular media outlets, actually do pay their dues to the government, and pretty much blames it all on the anarchy of the post-Soviet times and the anarchy of the Soviet collapse. So from the sort of literal standpoint, it all makes sense. From if you do know Russia and kind of scratch the surface, you know that words never mean exactly what they mean in Russia, and there are many, many more meanings behind every single sentence that there is, and reality actually does not correspond to the rhetoric.
Well, of course, here in the United States, we can't exactly be proud of our free press when we have the Pravda of the Republican Party, the Bush administration's Ministry of Information, Fox News, and the FCC trying to hand the entire media spectrum over to a handful of powerful interests. So there are certain parallels there. But let me go to the heart of the questions about Putin, and that is, you know, going back to the bombings of the apartment buildings in Moscow, which are still kind of murky, the handling of the Moscow theater attack, which Susan Eisenhower was talking about, where the gas was pumped in and many, many people died, and they didn't appear to be ready to, they didn't even admit to what drug they used, and had they admitted to the drug and had people standing by with the antidote, which is pretty easy, Narcan, the stuff that they give junkies when they overdose, they could have saved a lot of lives. So there were sort of echoes of the old system there. Again, you get this feeling that the past is still sort of past is still lurking there.
Well, the past is definitely still present, and the talk at Columbia, it was just absolutely, there was a Soviet man speaking, and you could just hear the phrasage and references to things that I learned or studied when I was in communist high school. So that is all there. And as for As for the Nordost Theater hostage situation, actually, it's kind of a very Russian thing. It's also very, very bizarre and very incoherent thing, but also very Russian, because what Russians try to do, they try to do the right thing, but then Russianism, Sovietism takes over, and the secrecy takes over, and absolute incoherency in strategy takes over, because they try to save their people by killing them. And that has been Russian history for centuries. I mean, that's what I noticed that at the arrangement, when the arrangements were made at Columbia University. I mean, one hand did not know what the left hand is doing. One of the examples, Putin brought the future Chechen president, Ahmad Kadyrov, with him to sort of promote the message that Chechnya is going to be civil and westernized part within the Russian Federation. And they were trying to arrange Kadyrov's own presentations at Columbia and Princeton and other universities. But then they had to cancel. And they had, after all these things were arranged, they had to cancel because it turned out that Kadyrov is not trained well enough yet. And he's still a very much of a Chechen rebel who was brought up by the Russians. And he may be a better rebel. I mean, in certain interviews, Putin alluded to the fact that he's sort of more coherent in what he wants to do in Chechnya, but maybe what he wants to do in Chechnya doesn't contradict what Putin wants to do in Chechnya, which is make it still part of the Russian Federation with no other options. So Kadyrov had to be canceled because the Kremlin wanted him to speak, but Kadyrov still couldn't speak. And this is sort of very similar to the Nordost when they try to do the right thing, but it just not there yet. It's so discombobulated, and PR always kind of contradicts the underlying message of this government. And so I think, sort of go back to your earlier question, Paul McCartney's buddy-buddy with Putin and closing down on the press is part of the same discombobulated message.
And I guess in terms of Ahmed Kadyrov, it's the old expression applies. I think it was FDR that, referring to the Somoza, the dictator in Nicaragua, he may be a son of a bitch, but he's our son of a bitch.
Exactly. That's exactly what it is. He's our son of a bitch. But it is so murky there that I don't even know whether they know he's a son of a bitch. They just, they have to put somebody to make sure the elections go on. And there was a good piece in the Times, in the New York Times, I think, last week, implying that Putin may want to put this duly elected, and I put it in quotation marks, Chechen president, and then just basically let them be. Mm. But, of course, this is very dangerous because then we know what the history of the Soviet Union leaving Afghanistan in 1989 was, and what happened, and just created Bin Laden, and then ultimately created September 11th. So, I do hope that they will not really abandon the Chechens to deal with themselves completely.
And what do you think about that? I mentioned it to Susan Eisenhower that back in Yeltsin at one point blamed the U.S. for all of the terrorism because of their support of the Mujahideen who drove the Soviets out of Afghanistan. But there's no question that every terrorist that struck the United States before and after 9/11 was trained in Afghanistan by the CIA and with Saudi money and organized through the Pakistani intelligence. So, in other words, we use the green to fight the red.
It is, and it's kind of one of those tragedies of history when we do things for whatever, we do wrong things for the right reasons or right things for the wrong reasons, whatever it is. I mean, definitely. So basically, this is another question of incoherency when we don't think about consequences. That's what happens. George Kennan, with whom I used to work at Princeton a little bit early on, once said that the successes of foreign policy should be defined not in the voting period, not in the election season, not even 5 years later. 10 years later is the minimum. And so basically, if we look at American foreign policy, for that matter, it's a sequence of various disasters. Some of there are definitely some successes, but a lot of them really not. And Russian policies are just one big disaster altogether.
But do you see, just in closing then, Nina Kosheva, do you see the U.S., and I imagine that one of the purposes of Bush meeting with Putin was to try and come up with some kind of working arrangement, both in Iraq and in the global war on terror. And the Russians have always wanted to say that we have our terrorist problem too, and and they're the same players.
Well, and that's what Putin is saying, and I think that's why President Bush was not really pushing him on Chechnya as hard as he should have, precisely because Putin is really very good at explaining things the way he wants to explain them. And President Bush obviously has his own problems with, you know, PR and public appearances and actually message corresponding reality altogether. So they were not really pushing each other on those issues, because I don't think politically it wasn't in the interest of one or another president to at least give each other a very hard time on that. But certainly, and I think they will find the common language, because in a way, if we do look at Putin as the successor of the Soviet regime, we can easily look at George Bush as a successor of the Nixon regime. And, you know, these were the best friendship years of or cooperation years between America and the Soviet Union. So why wouldn't it be between America and Russia today?
Well, I seem to recall in those days they had thousands of nuclear missiles pointed at each other.
Well, I mean, they had to, of course, they had to have some balance and parity of power. Now they have economic interests to keep the parity together. You know, Russians needed their influence in Iraq and their oil fields being developed. Americans need to quiet down Iran nuclear power. So they really have some leverage over each other. And I think that's what keeps them going, apart from the fact that they both feel strongly that the less public knows, the better.
I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles.
Thank you very much, Ian, for inviting me.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Hello again, I'm Ian Masters, and speaking there with Nina Kosheva, who is a professor of international relations at the New School in New York. I'm now speaking with Rahul Mahajan, who is the author of Full Spectrum Dominance, U.S. Power in Iraq and Beyond. And he's also the author of an article in The Progress, Gunpoint Democracy in Iraq. And Rahul, do you believe that the situation in Iraq vis-a-vis the Bush administration can be rescued? In other words, has it passed the point of no return, or is there still some way that the Bush administration can install some semblance of democracy or something that they can walk away from without it blowing up in their face, whether it be democracy at the point of a gun or any other brand?
Well, I think that the problem here is in a sense with the question. Everyone has been treating this as a matter of the Bush administration trying to stabilize things so that it can walk away. But that's not how I see it at all. If that was really the case, then you'd have to ask the question, why exactly did they go to war? We know they didn't go to war because of weapons of mass destruction. We know they didn't go to war because of any question of fighting al-Qaeda or similar terrorist organizations. And so if they really simply wanted to stabilize things and get out, then why exactly did they go to war? It was clearly not for building democracy, because if you look at the Bush administration's record in the last couple of years, I mean it's stunning. In Afghanistan, when they create the Loya Jirga and then they completely sabotage its process and force it to rubber stamp their own hand-picked candidate against the wishes of the delegates. In Venezuela, the National Endowment for Democracy funds the coup attempt against Hugo Chavez, who was democratically elected. So it's not for democracy. It's not for all these other reasons. It really simply wanted to get out. Then you have to ask yourself, why did they go to war?
Well, now, do you believe in this theory that the neocons conned the administration into this war, knowing that it would they'd break Iraq, it would essentially create chaos, destabilize Iraq's neighbors, and even lead to a broader war between Shiism and Sunniism, and therefore weaken the Arabs and strengthen Israel?
I think there are probably some neoconservatives, probably a small minority, who have thought in those terms, but that wasn't what the fundamental con was. The fundamental question, and it goes back even to the Clinton administration, where there's a lot of consideration about going to war with Iraq, is this. Iraq's oil is becoming increasingly important on the world market, and Middle Eastern oil in general will be. The sanctions have put Iraq's oil in a fundamental bind. It's not really able to increase its production, and so the prices are going to start rising. The sanctions have also made the United States projected as the enemy of the Iraqi government. So if the U.S. simply lifts the sanctions, it's very difficult for the United States itself to get control of Iraq's oil. And the big question is, what can we do about it? Can we go in and have a regime change and have a presence on the ground which stabilizes our control of the oil, or is that too much? Is that too much for the empire to take on? And this is the question over which the neoconservatives conned other parts of the establishment, including some parts of the military establishment, over the question of, do we have the wherewithal to fight what is very clearly now in Iraq a colonial war?
Well, but this is where I wonder whether this was thought through or whether there is something that you or I don't know. As far as I can tell, this Iraq thing has been a total disaster, and that they can't pump the oil. They can't. The saboteurs and the assassins seem to have the initiative. I'm not even sure they'll be able to have permanent bases there at the rate they're going. So I don't see how this has been in any way, U.S. hegemony over the oil supply. And also, this thing has destabilized the Arab world so much, the anger and the sense of humiliation is so great that I believe, for example, if the Israelis were to try and neutralize Arafat, the whole street could go up and the Saudis would be forced to pull the plug, as they did in 73. So yes, in other words, it's, if you wanted to stabilize and control oil, it seems like everything indicates it's backfired.
Well, yes, it has backfired, but that doesn't mean that wasn't their plan. The plan, unfortunately for them, they went about executing in a really stupid way. I mean, if I had tried to draw up a plan for how to do the occupation in the worst manner possible, I couldn't have come up with anything better than they did. But this is because of a fundamental intellectual failing of theirs. It's not because they had some different goals we're not talking about. It's because the neoconservatives really don't understand the simple point that you can't solve everything with the use of force, that you can't just ride over popular opinion, whether in Iraq or hopefully not even in the United States, simply by the use of greater force and the presence of coercion. So their plans have backfired, that's for sure. But the reason they have backfired is that they assumed that they could simply go in there, take out the regime, establish their presence and their coercion, and that the Iraqis would simply, worship force the way they do and not resist. And that's where the miscalculation has come in. And that is what Paul Bremer is trying to change now. I think he's a lot more realistic than these guys are about what has to be done if they want to cement the occupation. That's why the sudden talk about spending for Iraqi reconstruction, because he has been there on the ground and has understood that if they don't do that, they can't have any hope of even fooling the Iraqis into believing the occupation is good for them.
But Rahul Mahajan, the recently announced $86 billion that the president went on television to tell the American people that it was needed, that 90% of that goes for security. And you have to add that to the earlier allocation for the war. So that's a total of $166 billion so far, 90% of which goes towards the military. And they only have 1,000 people in there on the ground doing nation building, in terms of civilians. Apparently, Bremer's people have come up with a figure of $150 billion is needed for Iraqi infrastructure. So I don't see how, if 90% of it is going to the military, where you're going to find the... I mean, there's some doubt as to that the $86 billion is going to be allocated, although it probably will be, but where's this $150 billion coming from?
Yes, the truly shocking thing is that although, even if you construe it very, very broadly, at most $15 billion of that $87 billion is actually for any kind of reconstruction in both Afghanistan and Iraq. That still is a quantum leap over what has been done previously. The previous Iraq spending bill mandated $2.5 billion for reconstruction in Iraq over 2 years. This one has $6 billion alone just for repair of the electrical power. So it's not nearly enough, but it is a quantum leap over the shockingly low levels they had, which incidentally also show that the welfare of the Iraqi people is really never in their minds. And obviously, as they've said many times, they're looking to put the arm on the international community, which didn't fight this war and wasn't responsible for it, but is now supposed to pay for Iraqi reconstruction, even though I think any construal of international law would say that the aggressor nations, primarily the United States and the United Kingdom, assume liability for that reconstruction.
Well, I don't see too many people stepping up to the plate, though. Do you?
Yes, they're not stepping up yet, so this is just going to be yet another exercise in U.S. extreme strong-arm diplomacy, pushing these countries to do something they very clearly don't want to do. And the United States has obviously had many successes in this realm before, including the passage of UN Security Council Resolution 1483 in May, which turned over control of Iraq's oil revenues to the United States.
Well, do you see anything? I mean, anybody like? I know they've Teddy Kennedy said they were bribing the Turks. whether or not they were bribing them, it looks as though the Turks may come in with 10,000 troops, but that probably adds more complications than it helps because of, I think, a proviso of Turkish intervention is that they want to have a free hand to kill all the Kurds that are up there, left over from that guerrilla movement. So,
yes,
any indication? I know India, for example, promised troops and then they withdrew. Pakistan says maybe, but it has to be under the UN flag. And then the UN itself is starting to pull out. So give me a sense of what you think, where this strong arming is, what's it going to yield?
Yes. In terms of specific countries, there are not a lot that are stepping forward. Even in India, for example, it is really a minority even within the ruling party in the government that wants to send the troops, and basically everyone else in the country is united against it. Nevertheless, I mean, we have seen things like this happen before, you know, say in 1994 over the negotiations on the general agreements on tariffs and trade. You could hardly find a country where the massive population and the whole parliamentary opposition wasn't against ratification, but you had various executive branches ram it through because the United States just has phenomenal leverage, you know, through the World Bank and IMF, through unilateral trade sanctions, through its bilateral aid, and through this expanding network of military bases and military influence it has. It's this kind of influence, for example, that created the distinction between what Rumsfeld likes to call a new Europe and old Europe. The new Europe countries of Eastern Europe are now very much under the U.S. political sway because of the military influence that has come about through the process of what they call NATO expansion. So the United States has a lot of levers. This is why Poland was actually nominally at least one of the members in the so-called coalition to invade Iraq. It only sent 400 troops, but it was that. The United
States they have 10,000 there now. But the Poles
have 10,000 there now, yes.
Yeah. So just in closing then, Rahul Mahajan, what about the privatization here that's going on? There seems to be growing friction between the Governing Council and Paul Bremer, and obviously the Governing Council want to be running the country sooner, and it seems that they're giving away contracts all over the place to U.S. Companies to privatize education, oil sector. I mean, this is a country that worked under a kind of a mafia family that ran everything, and they had kind of some sort of nominal socialism in terms of healthcare and other things. But essentially, it looks as though we're going to go from one gangster running the whole show to a kind of Russian-style kleptocracy.
Very much so, and one of the changes you'll see is that the old mafia family, no matter even at the worst of its corruption, couldn't siphon off anywhere near as large a percentage of public revenues as these new gangsters will. And it's shocking to see that not only is the privatization moving forward on all fronts, I mean not just oil but every front, but how much of it is being directed to the cronies of the administration. I mean, there's even plans for the entire privatization to be handled by corporations like Bechtel that are very closely tied to this administration. And, of course, there's the latest revelations about the involvement of Joe Albaugh, who is a longtime Bush advisor and friend in this whole business. And it really it's shocking that they're imperiling their own grand imperial plans, in a sense, for this incredibly corrupt cronyism of the kind that characterizes, you know, the worst of crony capitalism anywhere, in places like Nigeria. It's very similar to what the Bush administration does here.
And is it? I understand something like one out of every $2 that go to Iraq goes through Halliburton, because they got the main sole source contract. I don't know what figures have you got.
That's been the case up until now. Although obviously, if they really do pass through these much larger sums for reconstruction, it's going to be difficult to maintain that.
Mm-hmm. So this is somebody's making some money out of this. In other words, to me, it looks like the biggest disaster in U.S. foreign policy in that I can remember, perhaps since Vietnam. And but it's if you're with Halliburton, it's not such a disaster. Although I can't see how in long term you're going to collect, because I just have this feeling that sooner or later the U.S. is going to be withdrawing either under fire or under some fig leaf of exit strategy.
Well, things haven't nearly come to that point yet. They're in there so that the oil can be controlled by U.S. military bases and by privatization to companies like ExxonMobil and Chevron Texaco. And unless there's a tremendous political cost, even greater than what they've seen so far, they're not going to leave without making sure that that has been taken care of.
I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles, Rahul Mahajan.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking then with Rahul Mahajan, who's the author of Full Spectrum Dominance, U.S. Power in Iraq and Beyond. I'm now speaking with Philip Coyle, who's a former Assistant Secretary of Defense and was head of test evaluation at the Pentagon. And Phil Coyle, let me just begin by reading from Joe Albaugh's prospectus here for his new company called New Bridges Strategies. And remember, he was Governor Bush's chief of staff in Texas, and then he went on to head FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency. And he left that job 3 months ago, and now he is launching a New Bridges Strategies, helping to rebuild a new Iraq. New Bridges Strategies LLC is a unique company that was created specifically with the aim of assisting clients to evaluate and take advantage of business opportunities in the Middle East following the conclusion of the U.S.-led war in Iraq. Its activities will seek to expedite the creation of free and fair markets and new economic growth in Iraq, consistent with the policies of the Bush administration. The opportunities evolving in Iraq today are of such an unprecedented nature and scope that no other existing firm has the necessary skills and experience to be effective, both in Washington, D.C. and on the ground in Iraq. Now, as far as I know, Phil Coyle, this is basically a way for American insiders to capture American taxpayers' dollars in a foreign land.
Yes, I don't want to say that Joe Albaugh is without expertise, but I expect there are many other American companies that would say that they could do that just as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, when you're in the Pentagon, weren't there some rules about leaving government service and then going in getting government contracts?
Yes, the Clinton administration was very tough about this revolving door issue, and said from the outset, during the campaign, as I recall, that they would have a 5-year rule, that they would have a rule that you couldn't go back, you couldn't go to a company with which you'd been having dealings as a government employee, you couldn't go to such a company within 5 years of leaving your government job.
And is there, I mean, when you're in the Pentagon, I didn't get the impression that this new phenomenon of the corporate warrior, as Peter Singer's book is titled, Peter Singer's a scholar at the Brookings Institution, who wrote a book, Corporate Warriors, which looks into this new phenomenon of the privatization of national security contracts, where you have former special forces and others working, for example, in Colombia, a couple of these guys who are flying surveillance were captured, and they're being held by the FARC. But apparently there's an awful lot of contractors on the ground in Iraq that are contracting out stuff that normally the military would be doing through the Quartermaster Corps.
Yes, and that some of that might still involve private companies. I think the most important thing is if the United Nations were more broadly involved, you'd also have broader participation from companies, international companies. And that's not to say that the people in those companies might not do everything they could to try to get work. They would be as competitive as they knew how to be, I'm sure. But if you have broader UN participation, then it's not simply American companies.
But isn't that logical, Phil Coyle? If the American taxpayer is paying for this war, then American companies should be first at the trough, right?
Well, George Bush, the President Bush the first, developed a coalition such that we paid for, in present dollar terms, only about $6 billion, less than 10% of the first Gulf War. So in that instance, U.S. taxpayers weren't having to carry such a burden as they are this time, where it's over $100 billion.
So, I mean, it's essentially, as far as I can tell, this war is not going well on any level and with any indication that it's getting better. But I guess it's safe and fair to say that the only people who are doing well out of this war are the Halliburtons and the Bechtels and these other contractors.
Yes, another thing the government can do, and the Clinton administration was quite aggressive about this also, was not always go to sole source contracts. When you go to sole source contracts, it raises questions about, well, how did this company get this contract? How come other companies weren't allowed to compete? And the Clinton administration worked very hard at requiring three-bid minimums from companies. And one of the advantages of that is you not only get broader participation and can deal with accusations of cronyism or whatever, but it also forces the government to decide what it is they really want, namely to have a plan, because before they can put something out for bid, they have to decide what it is they want these companies to do. And as many people have pointed out, a lack of a plan post the major part of the fighting has been our biggest problem.
Well, I understand, for example, that, you know, in Afghanistan, the company that subcontracts the security for Karzai, the head of state who's had about four or five assassination attempts against him, one of which was pretty close and was prevented by these, I guess they're ex-special forces guys. It's a private American company that protects Karzai, and one of the members of this detail apparently was involved with the rape of a woman or something, which is a major no-no, obviously, anywhere in the world, but particularly in Afghanistan. And they spirited this guy out of the country. But it leads you to think that maybe the private contractors don't have to play by the rules like the military have to.
Yes, and when you have private companies profiting from war in Iraq or any other place, and especially if it's only a few private companies, it really calls into question the U.S. motives for going to war. Was it to free the Iraqi people? Was it because of weapons of mass destruction? Was it for regime change? Was it because of oil and wanting to control that part of the oil market? Was it for the money in these contracts? So you need the broadest participation in industry that you can get, not only in the United States, so it's not just a few companies, but also internationally, which again is why the United Nations is so important.
But if this situation continues to turn bad, which it appears to be, it's difficult to say who has the initiative, whether those that want to undermine the U.S. presence there, they seem to have the initiative, but we're told, well, it's only bad in Baghdad, but everywhere else in the country, things are improving. What you can say, though, Phil Coyle, is that more and more money is going to have to be poured in there, because it's even... the Paul Bremer's people came up with a figure of $150 billion just for civilian infrastructure, and they originally allocated $2 billion. Then the $166 billion that's been allocated so far, most of which goes to the military. So there's clearly a lot of money going in there, and I guess the question is, if it has to go through these private hands, is this the most effective way of doing it, or is it this basically, you know, some sort of new form of welfare here for major corporations?
Well, the Bush administration can still put these contracts out for bid. There is no rule that requires them to make these sole source awards. They can still put these contracts out for bid and broaden the participation of industry in this work. And the Bush administration can also work with the United Nations and with other countries, including France and Germany, and get their companies involved, German and French companies involved, so that it doesn't appear that it's just U.S. companies that are benefiting.
Yeah, but I think asking the rest of the world to step into Iraq and put money up, it'd be like asking people to invest in Enron after the collapse, you know. I mean, how do you foresee anybody stepping up to the plate here, given that the United Nations themselves have just basically starting to pull out, saying that they can't be protected? Well, I just don't see it as a very attractive kind of climate for investment. Or is it? Are we not talking about investment?
Well, it certainly is a mess. There's no doubt about that. A great deal of damage has been done, but I'm sure there are companies in Europe, in France, in Germany, in Russia, all across the world. I'm sure there are companies that would like to participate, and in some cases, I think U.S. taxpayers would be glad to carry a larger part of the burden than we did in the first Gulf War. Even if firms from other parts of the world were the ones doing the work.
Well, I take it then that you feel that, if when you're in the Pentagon as the Assistant Secretary of Defense, you are living by the rules. The Clintons had a pretty strict rule about revolving door. Where is the outrage then if this, you have people like Joe Albuck, basically selling his so-called expertise to spend U.S. taxpayers' dollars in a war that doesn't seem to be going well, and the president keeps asking for more money and wants the world to bail us out of what may well be his mistake of his doing.
Yes, I think he's a special case in the sense that, as I understand it, he started a new company. And so I believe the government lawyers would tell him that he was not violating the conflict of interest provisions.
I see.
So he may not be the best example.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles, Phil Coyle.
My pleasure.
Thank you. Again, I'm Ian Masters. I was just speaking then with Philip Coyle, who's a former Assistant Secretary of Defense and head of test evaluation at the Pentagon. This program can be accessed at any time at ianmasters.org. I thank the producer and researcher, Lewis Vandenberg, and Mark Maxwell, the engineer.